This is Jeremy Bassetti, and you're listening to Travel Writing World, a podcast featuring interviews with travel writers about their work and about the business and craft of travel writing. You can find the episode show notes, free travel writing resources, and much more at travelwritingworld.com. Hello, everyone. Sorry for the radio silence. My son arrived earlier than expected, but all is well, and I've been enjoying spending time with the little boy. He likes to go on walks, and he gets cranky if he's not in a constant state of motion, so I think that's a good sign. And with what little free time I find, I've been busy putting together a book proposal. My goal is to get this proposal, you know, sample chapters and all, to a first draft stage by the end of the summer. So if you have any book proposal advice, please do drop me a line and send me good vibes. This is all to say that time has been limited, and yeah, sorry for not getting more episodes out. Anyway, today's episode is an interview I did with Ryan Murdoch about his new book, A Sunny Place for Shady People, How Malta Became One of the Most Curious and Corrupt Places in the World. The interview was actually an online event with Ryan's publisher, Trinity University Press, that was recorded fairly late in the evening for Ryan. If you recall, Ryan is the host of the Personal Landscapes podcast, which you should definitely check out while Travel Writing World is on paternity leave. Towards the end of the interview, I mention a discount code for Ryan's book through Trinity University Press. So seek out that code if you're interested in purchasing a copy. Sorry for the background noise. I'm in my garden. You might hear birds and airplanes and cars and things. Baby's having a meltdown inside, so I have to record outside. So now, here is Ryan Murdoch. It's an interesting book because it begins as a memoir and it has this kind of travel writing kind of vibe to it before descending pretty quickly into the madness that is Maltese politics and corruption. I think the book is ultimately about the tragic assassination of the investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia, who kind of you link to like a governmental tangled web of corruption, money, and power. But I want to talk about Daphne. I mean, she's central to this book. But before we get there, I was wondering if you could perhaps speak to a little bit as to how you and your wife landed in Malta of all places.
It was quite a random choice, I think. I'd fallen under the spell of a writer called Lawrence Durrell 10 years earlier while I was living in Tokyo. He wrote a famous novel sequence called The Alexandria Quartet. I don't know if you've read them. And three Greek island books, like about his experiences living on Greek islands. The first one was about Corfu in the 1930s. And he wrote about the spirit of place and how everyone has sort of a personal landscape that resonates with them. And for the writer, it's where you'll do your best work. And that really captured me. And years later, I went to Croatia in the south of France, and I kind of fell in love with that stony landscape and, you know, the olive trees and the translucent sea. And after several years trapped in Canada, when my small online publishing business was making, I had a fitness publishing business, when it started making enough money to live on, I convinced my wife that we should move to the Mediterranean and experience this spirit of place for ourselves. But it had to be a place that no one else had written about in that way, so I could contribute something new. So I searched around, and I think Sardinia was a contender at one point. I don't know why I ruled that out. Probably because D.H. Lawrence wrote about it so well already in Sea and Sardinia. And eventually I hit on Malta. It seemed very interesting, rich in history, and sounds like a good choice to me. So we gave notice on our house. She quit her job, and I called a shipping company, and they came and boxed up our things, mostly books. And I said, I'll give you an address in a couple of weeks. And yeah, we took off to with one-way tickets to find a house in the country we'd never visited before.
So you set out with the intention of moving to the Mediterranean to someplace to write a travel book or a travel memoir, yeah. History book.
A residence book. That's what I had envisioned initially. Something like Durrell's books were Full of his life in these places, full of culture, strange characters, the people he met, local legends, things like this that he had gathered in his period of residency. And he had all these crazy friends coming in to visit him, writers like Freya Stark or Patrick Lee Fermor. So I thought I'd spend 4 or 5 years writing kind of an upbeat island book inspired by Durrell. You know, I imagined myself living in a quiet old house and among the olives and having a regular cafe in a village where I would go and for every morning for a coffee and talk to old men in shabby coats and berets and, you know, soak up the culture, swim naked in the velvet sea, that sort of thing. Like in hindsight, I think I was kind of, I was imagining was probably just a projection of Lawrence Durrell's world, you know, Greece in the 1930s, just as the novelist James Salter kind of idealized the long gone world of Hemingway's Paris. And that's sort of what he had in his head. But the book that you were holding in your hand there and the book we're talking about today, isn't the book I set out to write, obviously. It's the story that I ended up having to tell because of the events we lived through.
And it's interesting because it seems from the beginning of the book, the first few chapters seems like it's going in that direction of a Lawrence Durrell book.
Yeah.
But the script gets flipped pretty quickly, I would say. It is interesting. You have a line in the book. I'm going to read it here. It's, I think, towards the end. You said, "We moved to Malta because I was inspired by Lawrence Durrell's breezy Mediterranean vision." And here's the kicker. "But the island's spirit of place exerted a malevolent influence, like radon gas silently poisoning a house." Talk about that silent killer, the radon gas.
Yeah, so there was a lot going on below the surface. So like in the beginning, as you're getting to know a new place, a lot of those, the incidences that I described in the beginning of the book, they're comical, you know, like that. I think of these kind of stories as clash of culture. And I really love that sort of stuff where, you know, the foreigner and the local person are acting on completely different assumptions of social norms or of what the conversation's saying or what's happening in the scene, but they're completely at cross purposes without knowing it. And, you know, comedy usually is the result of it, of this confusion. It all gets worked out in the end, but the best stories are when I'm the butt of the joke. Usually I like those sorts of comical scenes. And it did start like that in the beginning. There was a lot of comedy and funny encounters. But I quickly started to see that there's something more going on below the surface of this place. There was something not sinister in the air, but I mean, there were clearly things happening. And I tried to develop that over the course of the early chapters in the story, how that sunny surface gradually revealed some of the tensions in villages, some of the strange crimes that were going on around the periphery that people seemed to treat as though they were normal, you know, the darker sides of the island, the construction boom, the theft of public land by squatters, you know, these kind of things sort of percolated through. And in the beginning, everybody was connected and everybody had a story, you know, like they're in a small island place like that, small geographies and boundaries matter more. And people know like when you go out shopping in a village, for example, everybody knows who you are within the first 2 minutes of walking down the street. Everybody knows your family, your ancestors, what you bought last week. It's sort of like living in a panopticon, but everybody also knows who's connected to who when it comes to these criminal families or, you know, corrupt politics and these networks of influence pervade the entire place. So I started to sort of see more and more of that as time went on and to pay more attention to it.
Yeah, we do get the sense of surveillance, especially early on in the early chapters of the book. Coming back to this idea of, you said, the comical clash of cultures and kind of like the comedy that sometimes comes with visiting a foreign place and how this kind of, you know, you use this to kind of illustrate the corruption and the issues on the island. I'm thinking here about one chapter in particular where you discuss the modernization of the bus fleet on Malta. And on first, it seems like a comical chapter. There's, you know, it's funny, but I think it tees up very nicely what's to come in the later chapters of the book in terms of money laundering, in terms of corruption and those types of kind of major issues. So I was wondering if you could perhaps touch on the bus fiasco, as it were, and how is this indicative of Maltese politics and corruption writ large?
Yeah, that's a good example, because like those early days in Malta were sometimes frustrating, but they were always always comical and always really interesting. And the bus story did end up kind of resulting in it did get corrupted in the end. It was after the change in government, but in the beginning, it was a very well-meaning attempt to modernize the island's bus fleet. Like when we first moved there, the buses of Malta were so old that they had become a tourist attraction. Like they were. Like they had die-cast, like matchbox car versions of the buses in the tourist shops alongside statues of knights, you know, for the Knights of Malta, and, you know, pottery and glass and things like this. They were old British Bedford buses brought by during the British period, you know, in the 1950s, I think. So most of them dated back to, and each was owned by its individual driver, and who lavished great attention on the interior of the buses. Some of them were so encrusted with religious iconography that they're like portable shrines. You know, they took a lot of care in the decoration, and most of them had slogans on the front. Like I remember one that said "Heaven in Hell," and another said "Sex Machine." I don't know what kind of ride they were offering, but they didn't lavish nearly as much as attention on the parts that you didn't see, like the suspension or the engine. So they weren't a very comfortable ride. Like, in the summer, the temperature inside everything metal would be like the temperature of a branding iron on bare skin. And in winter, it's like driving around inside a musty humidifier. But, you know, all of this was about to change when we first came to the island, because the government had bought a fleet of new air conditioned buses. But they were used buses, and they bought them from China. But, you know, Malta was going to make one giant time machine leap from the 1950s to the early 2000s overnight. And, I still remember the anticipation that this was greeted with. You know, like it was in the newspaper all the time. The buses are on the way. They've left China. You know, they're going to arrive any day now. The Archbishop is photographed blessing the buses, and then they're about to roll out in their new uniform, blue and white paint job, and transform our commuter experience. And that was when everything started to go wrong. In the first case, all the old bus drivers expected, it was run by a company called Arriva. They run public transportation in like 15 European Union countries or more successfully. And they thought everybody would thank them for this task, that they were bringing this to Malta, but they should have brought an anthropologist, because they really misunderstood the Maltese. So the first problem was that they didn't hire all the old drivers en masse at the same, with the same perks and a higher rate of pay, because quite a lot of them weren't up to their standards. So their refusal to just take them on anyway, it was like a stab in the back to the local patronage network. So on the day that everything was set to roll out, half the drivers didn't show up for work. And then just total chaos on day one was just the beginning. The problem with the buses was Maltese streets are very small. Some of these villages are, you know, they're medieval streets. They twist and turn with a medieval irregularity. And the King Long buses, as the name would suggest, were very large, and they just didn't fit. Some were these big bendy buses. So I remember one story, there was a guy, a driver had failed to memorize his route. So he started taking directions from a passenger, and the street just gets narrower and narrower. And when he's past the point of no return, he can't admit his error. So he just plunges forward anyway, until he's wedged between buildings. And this happened all the time. The buses found themselves wedged between buildings. And, you know, the newspapers always reported it in the passive tense, like they found themselves wedged, like nobody could understand how they got there. It was just something that happened, not something that was caused. And there were stories of, you know, a bus driver would try to squeeze past an illegally parked car, and he wouldn't make it, of course. But when it starts grinding metal against metal, he'd just floor the gas and drag the car down the street until it rips away. And, you know, within 2 years, these buses looked like they'd been beaten. They'd been worked over by secret police. Like they were dented and battered, and the air conditioning was broken, and most of them were trailing great clouds of black fumes as though they were powered by coal, and then they began to catch fire. The unmaintained engines would just go up in flames, like when it was sitting idling next to just in the parking lot or with passengers on board. So the whole thing was just an absolute disaster. They did try to fix it. You know, the traffic is quite bad, so that was also going wrong for them. In the end, the company just threw up their hands after, I think, 3 years of a 10-year contract and walked away. It became corrupted after that, but you know, this is how I remember my early Island years. It was the best laid plans always seemed to kind of go wrong like that, but there was something endearing about the way these cobbled together solutions would sort of work themselves out. But then there was an election, and that's when everything changed. So, like, the life took a darker turn when the Labour Party returned to power after 25 years in the political wilderness. They were cast into the political wilderness for this long because there was a period of corruption and violence in the 80s that was quite terrible. So they were kind of unelectable until this new charismatic young leader showed up. And when power changes hands in Malta, the new government removes the supporters of the other party and fills every position with supporters of its own, like from top to bottom. Even the people in the village pharmacy in our little village had changed. So the Maltese world is divided into two hostile camps and kind of a winner-take-all political game dominated by clientelism and nepotism and open trading and influence for votes. So you don't run for office because you want to make the country better. You run because of what you can get, and your supporters vote for you because of what you can give them personally if you win. So, like, when election season is on, somebody might come into a local party office and say, well, you know, I want a job. Nothing too difficult, like maybe a night watchman, so I can just go in and punch the clock and then go in and, you know, sleep in the back room, or go straight out the back door and over to my normal job and collect the pay for both. Or you might have built something illegally and you want it regularized, you want a permit for it. So you'll trade that, you know, and ask for that in exchange for your vote. And the other thing too that's important, the governing party has enormous power in Malta, and it's all centralized and embodied in the office of the prime minister. So every appointee from every institution that matters answers directly to him and is indebted to him for their job personally, including the institutions that are supposed to keep his power in check. So this new Labour prime minister, Joseph Muscat, used that power systematically and deliberately to exploit each of the country's institutional weaknesses when he came to power. So like they had 5 police commissioners in 4 years until he found one that could be relied on to look the other way whenever there was corruption allegations against him and his inner circle. A guy called Major Jeffrey Kermy, he was a close family friend of the Muscats. He was promoted 3 times in 3 months up to Brigadier General and then made commander of the Armed Forces of Malta. So now that answers to Muscat. And the same process was followed with the head of every regulatory body. And then those that couldn't be compromised were just starved of resources, so they couldn't do their job. So the result was a total impunity that kind of gradually trickled down to all levels of society. So economically, the country was really on the rise at that time, and you could see that people were growing richer, but I really felt a sense that the bounds were slipping, and this is quickly going downhill. So that was the situation after the election.
Yeah, and it seems like some of these issues may be kind of a softer type of corruption, but it really is indicative of a larger problem. You'd mentioned in relation to the bus fiasco, something about local patronage networks. And elsewhere in the book, in a few chapters, you talk about some of these kind of deep-seated issues are perhaps cultural issues. You bring up the concept of omerta, and you bring up this concept of amoral familialism, which it seems like you're touching on here. So I was wondering if you could talk about these two concepts, omerta and amoral familialism, and you know, tie this back to kind of the broader picture of corruption in Malta.
Yeah, so omerta is basically the code of silence, the same as you would read about Sicily. Like, don't cooperate with the authorities, in particular in any kind of police investigation. Say nothing, see nothing. Everybody in a small place like this, everybody knows who, you know, set the neighbor's door on fire, or everybody knows who was responsible for this crime. But nobody says anything. I could tell you about that later. The place that we first lived in Malta, the village and the house we rented, it was really cool. Down the street from that place, just after we moved and We lived there for about the first place, about 2.5 years. And about a week after we moved, a guy was shot at the end of the street. Somebody just knocked on his door and, you know, shot him in the throat and chest. And it turned out he was a bomb maker in the 80s. And he was still, you know, plying his trade in his garage. And I could see it from my roof. You know, I parked in front of his house sometimes. There are always these shady people hanging out there. And after he was shot, people said, oh, yeah, he was a bomb maker. Like, everybody knew it. But nobody says anything. And nobody saw anything that day. That's for sure. So that's Omerta. Moral familism, that's a social science theory. It was first described by an American political scientist called Edward Banfield in a book called The Moral Basis of a Backward Society. It was a study of a rural village in the south of Italy. So this concept was first applied to Malta by an anthropologist called Jeremy Boissevin. He lived there in the 60s. He wrote a very famous ethnography about Maltese feasts and the festas. But in another book, he wrote about a moral familism and how it's sort of underpins the entire society in Malta. So under a moral familism, any action undertaken to benefit your family or yourself is justifiable regardless of whether it's legal or ethical. And you expect everybody else to be acting in the exact same way. So, you know, corruption is seen kind of as an opportunity rather than a badge of shame, and getting caught is just bad luck. And, you know, Charlie's doing it too, so why are you picking on me is a legitimate explanation. So sort of each family is pitted against every other family in a zero-sum competition for resources. And everyone feels entitled to take as much as they can for themselves because everyone else is doing it. And it's a controversial theory. Some anthropologists have disputed it, at least, in relation to Italy. There are three papers that get cited usually when they're refuting this theory. And I read them all, and it didn't convince me. I didn't find it at all compelling, at least not in the Maltese context. I've not seen it refuted. And I understand why it's controversial. I mean, it's a pretty ugly description of a society, but at the same time, I can understand how such a worldview might have developed as a survival strategy, you know, because Malta is quite a small island. It's, 20 miles by 12 miles wide, 20 long, 12 wide. So that's about 30 kilometers by 20 kilometers in Canadian, with 500,000 people crammed onto it. It can't feed itself. There's not enough resources for the population, not enough water anymore for the population. Cisterns won't provide enough water for that many people in the rainy season. So they desalinate water. It doesn't really produce much. There's no resources. So in a situation like that, on an island that always lacked natural resources and that was far too overpopulated to look after its own people or support its own people, there's very little to go around. And, you know, what wealth there was came from outside. So it was either brought to the island by whatever colonial overlord was controlling it at that point, and just about everybody did at one point or another. Or you either had to get it from them or you had to take it from them, steal from the dockyards, from the British or whatever. And you had to grab it before somebody else could grab it first if you hope to survive. So I can understand a system like that would work in a small closed in society like that, where there was a fixed set of resources that everybody was kind of scrambling for. And it really must have been quite desperate at times. But when Malta joined the European Union, that wealth from outside became like an unlimited source of funds. And with the election of Joseph Muscat, a moral familism cascaded out of control. So I gave it such prominence in my book for two main reasons, really. One, because after studying this concept, after reading Boissevin, it was like the wheels of a cipher had locked into place. Like all these inexplicable things I'd seen in the life around me, stuff that just made no sense. People's decisions, you know, the way people acted, it just suddenly made sense to me after reading that, if I looked at it through that lens. And it seemed to have great predictive value. Like when I was, if say a politician would get caught with their hand in the cookie jar in the Muscat years, which happened every week. And if I looked at it through the lens of a moral familism, I could predict what they were going to say, how they would explain themselves, and exactly how their followers would interpret it and what they would say. So it was very helpful for writing magazine columns or newspaper columns rather. And the other reason I gave it such prominence is because Daphne Caruana Galizia, the journalist who you mentioned earlier, she put a lot of emphasis on it. And her story is central to the second half of my narrative. So She wrote on her website that nobody can seek to understand Maltese politics or Maltese society without first understanding immoral familism. It shapes and drives both, and it has ruined both. So she was a strong believer in this. All that being said, it shouldn't be interpreted as a blanket condemnation of Maltese society or Maltese people. And I think that's what gets a lot of people's back up. I met many people who couldn't possibly be, you know, described as immoral familists. And I talked about a lot of them in the book, these journalists that I worked with, the protesters who tried to bring down Muscat. These people, this doesn't describe their actions or their beliefs. So it's a lens for looking at things that were happening there, and a very useful one, but it's not a condemnation.
Yeah. I'll just take a moment here to remind the audience that if they would like to ask questions, they can drop them in the chat, and I'll, if I see them, I'll try to get to them while we're live.
Yeah, I expect to see some questions from you people too, you know, make me look popular.
this kind of characterization of Maltese society as somewhat amoral is interesting on the surface because, you know, from this perspective, knowing very little about Malta, it seems like it's a fairly moral place that has kind of these deep kind of religious convictions. I think Paul Theroux wrote that the island was priest-ridden, and you mentioned somewhere in the book that you know, you could visit a different church every day of the year. There are so many of them. So what do you make of this kind of, I don't know, this contradiction or this false sense of morality that we see on the island?
That's just, there were a lot of churches. Just the first village I lived in, I think there were three I could see from my roof, and they all, the bells went off constantly, but they were all out of sync. So they all chimed the right hours at the wrong intervals. Just a constant noise of church bells. There's a pragmatism to life there. I don't think younger people are religious at all. Like the old people were. You would still see a lot of old ladies, especially, going to church every day. And the church controlled the place for quite a long time. Like after the Arab period, when the Normans came and reimposed Catholicism, the church was quite powerful, especially in these rural villages. So the church was the main source of authority, and they had their own Inquisition, and this sorts of things. So there's also a deeply held belief that St. Paul himself brought Christianity to Malta. That's been disputed by German theologians. There were a lot of, it's based on one line in the Bible, one kind of inconclusive line that mentions an island called Melita, which referred to two or three places in the Mediterranean, not just Malta. But the Jesuits kind of latched onto that. And it seems that they grafted this story of St. Paul onto a local cult that had already been there in the sea, what's now called St. Paul's Bay, but this sort of a fisherman's cult, and said that this was actually the story of St. Paul, and he brought Christianity to Malta, and Malta's always been Christian since that time, you know, a staunch defender of Christianity on the front lines against Islam throughout history. And that wasn't true at all. I mean, the place was entirely depopulated in 870, left abandoned for about 100 years, and then repopulated from North Africa. So the roots are very much North African of the culture, the roots of the language. So Christianity has a strong hold on the island, and people really identify with the North rather than the South. They look towards Italy, but daily life is quite pragmatic. Like, divorce was illegal on the island up until there was a referendum when we first moved there. So if you look on the income tax form, just about everybody I knew was divorced, sometimes multiple times, but the income tax form said single, married, but not living together or something. Like, so they de facto, they recognized divorce, and everybody did it, but the rich went abroad to do it, and it was recognized in Malta, but the people who couldn't afford to do it, they just, you know, moved on with their life anyway. And the government kind of had ways of working around it and recognizing it. So I think the Christian ethos was maybe observed on the surface, and probably a lot of older people still felt it deeply, but it didn't seem to interfere with what people actually wanted to do.
And of course, we see that in other parts of the world. You'd mentioned Daphne. And I was wondering if we could turn our attention to this part of the story. I think the Maltese, from what I gather from your book, you know, Maltese corruption and, you know, the power exploits and those issues came to a head with the murder of the investigative journalist Daphne Caruana Galizia. And I was wondering if you could, you know, tell us a little bit about who Daphne was and about her work. And like, I know it's a little bit complicated. I'm still trying to wrap my head around everything that you write about in the book, but what was she about to uncover that was pissing people off?
Yeah.
Especially the people with power.
So she was Malta's best investigative journalist. She grew up in during the 80s, during this time of political corruption under the Mintoff years. And that really shaped her view of government and society. It turned her into a journalist, I think, a natural journalist. She had actually studied archaeology. She went back to school as a mature student after having a family and studied archaeology. And I think that's what gave her this meticulous attention to detail to piece these things together. But so she was the first independent newspaper columnist in Malta to write under her real name. Up until then, people were writing in pseudonyms, and because they were afraid of reprisals and retaliation for writing about these politicians. And nobody could believe that this 25-year-old woman, you know, was writing this stuff, because it was quite a misogynistic society at the time. But so that, by the time I lived there, she was the most widely read newspaper columnist in the country. And her blog running commentary, but she started this blog so that she would be uncensored by editors and she could write whatever she wanted. By the time this political crisis struck, she was getting more traffic than all the newspapers combined in the country. So she was really pivotal. She was setting the agenda in a lot of ways. And she scooped everybody. Like, she always seemed to know what was happening. She had an incredible investigative instinct. And she had I really admired her writing style. Like, she was concise. She was very direct in a way that, you know, other writers in Malta generally weren't. And she could do sarcasm. She could do sarcasm and irony really well. And people didn't seem to get that there. She was controversial in part because her satirical writing could kind of verge on political gossip sometimes, and that brought lots of people to her website. And she was absolutely scathing with some of that stuff. But I think I can understand why it offended some people. But to me, it always seemed like it came from a place of anger, in the sense that, like, when your elected officials are acting like such, you know, beneath contempt, like greedy, they're acting in a way that wasn't fit for the role that they were elected to serve. And she felt, you know, we deserve better than that. And Malta deserves better than that. She wanted them to rise up to higher standards. So she just savaged, you know, kind of bogan behavior when she saw it. So to cite her name was kind of to take sides in the ongoing village football match that is Maltese politics. You're either nationalist or you're labor, red or blue. And typically your family would have been labor or nationalist going back generations. And these two sides that are always fighting for resources. And it's a bit of an existential struggle too. Like, when you vote for one of these parties, you're voting for them because of what they can give you. And if they lose power, you might be out of a job. So, you know, you really identify with the political party that you support. So those in power hated her so much because she was exposing all of this stuff. She had a network of spies and informants who would tell her, you know, tip her off because they trusted her. She had this instinct. She knew who was connected to who was related to who held what position in previous governments. Like, she could put the pieces together so quickly, and she wasn't afraid of them. Like, she couldn't be silenced or intimidated. And she kept uncovering everything. So they tried to silence her. I mean, she was threatened. Her front door was lit on fire. Her pets had their throats slit over the years. Lawsuits. Maltese politicians like libel suits because, you know, you can be accused of something. You could say, well, fine, I'm going to sue you and I'll see you in court. And then they kick it down the road. But the journalists who they're suing, they have the resources of a government behind them and government lawyers. But the journalists who they're attacking has to, you know, front up the cash and go to court or you lose automatically. So they use this as a method of intimidation. Like, at the time she was killed, I think she had 42 libel suits still pending against her. A pile of them were filed by this one big developer in Malta, all by the same guy, and the rest were politicians. So The government, by the time the big political crisis struck, the government had come to regard her as the only real opposition in the country because the opposition party was really ineffective and divided. And they turned their entire online propaganda machine against her, labeling her as a traitor to Malta. Billboards saying, you know, if you want to stop the country from being tarnished abroad, go to Bidnia, where she lived. There's where the problem is. The witch of Bidnia and this blogger, the prime minister had like a childhood friend, this bloated, you know, horrible writer, semi-literate guy called Glenn Bedingfield. He wrote a blog, a counter blog to Daphne from the office of the prime minister, paid by the prime minister's office to attack a journalist. And they didn't see that this is third world behavior. So by the time she was killed, like total strangers hated her who had never read her writing. I mean, she was blown up with a massive car bomb just down the road from her home. Within hours, photos of her burned body parts were being circulated on social media. Photos taken at the crime scene, obviously by police. And members of closed Labour Party social media groups were celebrating her death. Like the shift infiltrated these groups, and they've got screenshots of this. And group members included senior politicians. So they were afraid of her because of the dirt that she kept uncovering.
There was some news story that I believe was coming to a head at that moment that she was about to uncover. I'm still trying to wrap my head around everything. It's a tangled web.
It's very confusing.
It's incredibly confusing, but I think if I'm remembering correctly, it's related to the Panama Papers that she was about to kind of disclose. And very briefly, can you help me understand what the heck Papers were?
In the book, I only cover the central thread of corruption that we think it was what got her killed. I mean, there was so much more, but I had to include a cast of characters in the timeline. It gets so convoluted. Even for the people working on this, it was complicated. So the Panama Papers was kind of the first. There were a lot of small corruption stories when Muscat first took power, but the Panama Papers was really big. So for those who don't remember it, it was early 2016. There was a massive data hack of the servers of a Panamanian law firm called Mossack Fonseca. And, you know, a bunch of journalists got their hand on it, an international consortium, and they analyzed the data. And then they published this massive expose in it. It exposed how the world's rich avoid taxes legally by using secret offshore companies hidden behind nominee directors, trusts, and this sort of thing. And there were a lot of European names on that list and a lot of famous names, but only one EU country had a sitting government minister on the list. And you know, guess who? So the leak revealed that two top Maltese government officials had opened secret offshore companies in Panama within days of the Labour Party's election to power. One was the energy minister, a guy called Conrad Mitzi. And the other was the prime minister's chief of staff, a former businessman called Keith Schembri. And there was a third company opened at the same time as these other two. But the beneficial owner of that one was so sensitive that the fixers in Malta would only reveal it over Skype. So they wouldn't even give the name. I mean, who's more sensitive than the chief of staff, the second most powerful guy in the country? And so like this for people who don't understand this world, this isn't like walking into your local bank branch and coming out with a savings or a checking account, you know, 20 minutes later. Like, there's a lot of documents to prepare. Multiple pieces of identification have to be notarized, bank reference letters, proof of your source of funds. And if you're a politically connected person, you're toxic. Like, they really need to investigate you. So the timing indicates the fact that they opened these accounts, within days of being elected, the timing indicates that they were waiting to see if they won the election before setting this plan in motion. So it would take a lot of time to unravel those threads, but those three Panama companies were really a key. Like because they were tied to this corrupt power station deal that you mentioned. This was the Labour Party's big political promise, their big campaign promise, and they were tied to it, the three Panama companies. And so was the man eventually accused of commissioning Daphne's murder. So This all of this happened about a year after the Panama Papers. She started unraveling the threads, and at the time of her death, she was working through a massive collection of leaked documents from a whistleblower within this electric gas power station. One of its directors, a guy called Jürgen Fenwick, the richest man in Malta, the heir to the, you know, the Tumas business group fortune, owner of the Hilton Hotel. He was the owner of a secret Dubai company called 17 Black, and that was linked to large transfers of funds from Azerbaijan. The reason Azerbaijan was involved, Joseph Muscat and his inner circle had made a secret trip there, which Daphne exposed after it happened. Nobody knows what the meeting was about, but Malta signed a secret side deal with SOCAR, the Azerbaijani natural gas company, to purchase liquefied natural gas for this power station at inflated prices for a period of 18 years. So Azerbaijan doesn't produce natural gas. They were just buying it from Shell or somebody else and then reselling it to Malta for a massive markup. So Daphne knew about this. She knew these Panama companies were connected to this 17 Black. And she knew 17 Black was used to move money in and out of Dubai, but she didn't know that Jürgen Fenwick owned it. That came out after she died. Reuters figured that out after a big investigation. But 17 Black was also named as the source of funds on the Panama Company Incorporation documents filed by the energy minister and the chief of staff. They were expecting to get 5,000 euros a day from 17 Black. So at the time that all this was coming out, Electrogas was formed as a company, but it wasn't up and running yet. And they were bleeding money like crazy. Like they were really on the brink of insolvency before they even started producing any energy. So they were trying to get funding from abroad. So if she had exposed this, these ties between the owner of one of the directors of Electrogas, the Panama company is opened by these politicians, and alleged kickbacks, you know, and the political corruption, it would have potentially sent, the funding would have dried up. Nobody's going to touch this. The funding would have collapsed. And if the Electrogas company collapsed, it would have potentially sent a massive government-backed loan, secretly backed, into default. So if she had had time to put the pieces together, it would have ended their roadmap to riches, because this power station, the Panama companies, were all part of a very clear plan, as was weakening the institution. So nothing could be done to them as they started to enact their plan. And it would have potentially caused a banking crisis in Malta, collapsed the national bank. So she was very close to figuring this out when she was killed. So it's believed that police seem to believe, and the journalists I speak to think, that this is what probably led to her death.
Yeah, and your book details the murder for hire plot, the individuals involved, how they pulled this off, and ultimately how they got pulled down. And I think there's still some trials here. Now, from what I understand, there's this kind of alleged, help me understand this, if the connection directly to Muscat connection is direct, or is it alleged, or have they connected that piece of the puzzle?
So
that stand
there, these guys are woven together in a very tangled web. Like so I want to make sure I get all the details correct here. The guy who was the middleman in the assassination was a bookie called Melvin Thuma. The police had a sense, like Europol was involved in investigating this. They'd already caught the hitman thanks to, one of the security services, the counterterrorism head, I think his name was George Carmona. When the bomb happened, he immediately called the Americans in Rome, and they sent an FBI squad and some Dutch experts from Europol, because he knew that they would triangulate the phone data. So they were able to catch these guys based on cell phone data. He didn't ask his superiors before he made the call. He only told them after. And so what are they going to do? They have to catch these guys. And they sat on ice for about 2 years. Didn't say a word. The only thing that changed when those guys were arrested was that all the car bombs on the island stopped. There had been about 16 at the time, just during the time we lived there. And, you know, if everything stopped when these guys were picked up, everybody knew who was doing it. Like, these guys were bottom feeding career criminals on welfare, but, you know, vacationing in Monaco and living lavish lifestyles. So they caught these guys, and the Europol investigators were zeroing in on this guy, Melvin Thuma. They were going to pick him up on a money laundering investigation, but they knew he was involved in quite a lot more. He was tipped off by somebody within the office of the prime minister. The Joseph Muscat's chief of staff, Keith Schembri, the guy that was one of the Panama Papers, one of the Panama Papers guys, he was sitting in on these security briefings, and he was tipping off Jürgen Fenech, his close childhood friend. So when they picked up this guy, Melvin Thuma, and arrested him, he was expecting another police officer called Raymond, the head of the economic crimes unit, to be there and, you know, to search only where he was supposed to search. And then he would be like, oh, but they showed up 2 days early. Europol jumped the gun and they showed up without Raymond. So he immediately knew, okay, this is not going to go well. And he had an ice cream tub filled with recordings he had made of the alleged mastermind, conversations between them about setting up the assassination. And he said, oh, you know, I want to turn state's witness in exchange for immunity to testify against him. So nothing happened for about a week, and the newspapers knew who he had named. Everybody knew, but it was just sort of in a holding pattern. And then the Times of Malta leaked it out that the suspected mastermind was a prominent businessman. That night, 4 a.m, Jürgen Fenech was picked up in his yacht trying to run away from the island. The last person he spoke to before he cut and run was Keith Schembri, the chief of staff of the prime minister. They spoke for about 20 minutes. So he just, all hell broke loose when this guy was arrested. Finally, you know, all the people realized, people who were in denial all along realized that everything Daphne was writing was true. And it resulted in these massive protests that filled Valletta night after night throughout November and into December. They intensified when Keith Schembri suddenly resigned and the next morning was arrested for questioning. And Conrad Mitzi, the corrupt energy minister, he also was forced to resign by his fellow cabinet ministers because he was bringing down the sinking ship, you know. But Joseph Muscat clung to power throughout quite a lot of that. He was finally driven out by these protests, while claiming that he was just taking the fall. He had to take responsibility for everybody, even when I'm not responsible. And he basically engineered, there was a leadership race and his handpicked successor won based on a mandate of continuity. So Muscat's still protected. When Jürgen Fenech was arrested, the businessman, the alleged mastermind, he said Keith Schembri put him up to it. The chief of staff, he was fishing for a pardon too, and he didn't get it. So he's been in custody now for, I think, 4 years. So well, since 2019, December 2019, no, late November 2019, his trial hasn't started yet. They've been going through all kinds of pre-trial, you know, trying to get it thrown out, looking for loopholes. And he said when he was picked up, if I go down, everyone goes down with me. Not he goes down, as in Keith Schembri, who he claims was the real mastermind, but everyone goes down. So how far wow. up it goes, I don't know. So, wow. as of now, she was killed in October 2017, and the two main hitmen, the guy who triggered the bomb, the DiGiorgio brothers, they denied everything right up until the last minute, and then they suddenly pled guilty after admitting what they had done on a podcast with a Reuters detective or with a Reuters journalist. The middleman, he got a deal to turn to state's witness. He got a presidential pardon. The third hitman, who served as a lookout while they planted the bomb in her car, he cut a deal to testify against them, even though I don't think the evidence was needed. I mean, they already had the phone evidence, and he got it 15 years, I think. And Jürgen Fenech is accused. He's not on trial yet. It hasn't started. And no politicians that were linked to this case had been questioned, arrested, or charged with anything. The other thing, yeah, it's important to know, when Fenech was arrested, this rich businessman, his phone revealed all kinds of interesting details. Like, he was on group chats with the prime minister and the chief of staff. They were all buddy-buddy. He attended Joseph Muscat's, you know, birthday party, gave him a 20,000 euro watch. you know, bottle of expensive wine from the year of his birth, lavish gifts. He hung out with Keith Chembry. He was hanging out with the lead investigator on the case, who was vacationing on his yacht. The lead investigator, a deputy, Silvio Valletta. Fenwick's kids called him Uncle Silvio. So I mean, like this, you've just completely enmeshed with these politicians and this businessman and the Panama companies and the power station deal. Whether they'll ever tie it back to the politicians, I don't know, but they did hold an independent public inquiry against their will, imposed by the Council of Europe, and damning testimony came out of that. And in the end, the judges who led the public inquiry found the Maltese state responsible for Daphne's death. They were complicit, and the entire government, not just the inner circle, and the office of the prime minister, in part for enabling this impunity that trickled down from the prime minister's office. They described it like an octopus, its tentacles reaching out from the prime minister's office and corrupting everything.
It's an apt metaphor for kind of unchecked power. We have a question from the audience. Ryan, do you think Malta joining the EU was overall a positive or a negative influence on the Maltese political culture, especially regarding the amoral familism?
I remember Caroline telling me, Caroline Muscat, who formed, for those who don't know her, she formed The Shift, an independent Maltese news outlet, right after Daphne was killed. She was a friend of Daphne and a prominent journalist on the island. She told me that her and Daphne talked about this often, and they voted to join the EU because they thought it would protect them from their own worst impulses. You know, they thought it would prevent a repeat of the violent 1980s under a previous Labour government, that it would sort of exert a civilizing effect. It did enrich the island. I mean, the quality of life for people went up enormously, and it brought funding across all different areas. Some of it gets, you know, embezzled away or put towards cronies and corrupt purposes, but I think it made people's lives a lot better. It gave people the opportunity, younger people especially, to go and work in Europe and in other countries, to be educated outside of Britain. And, you know, it opened up other, there was a special relationship with Britain because of the colonial years. So people could go to school in Britain, but it opened up the entire European Union to them. And Daphne's sons all studied abroad and worked abroad. So I think it was a net positive in that regard across the board, but it wasn't capable of protecting them from their own worst impulses because the European Union's powers are quite limited. And, you know, when they formed the EU, I don't think they ever, there's mechanisms for adding countries, but there's no mechanism for kicking a country out when they're not, you know, living up to their agreements, for example. And you see some issues with countries in Eastern Europe now clashing with the EU. But with Malta too, one of the money-making schemes that Joseph Muscat and his inner circle did quite well from is the sale of passports, the individual investment program, individual citizenship by investment, which, you know, everybody calls cash for passports. When he went to the European Union and told them they were going to start doing this, they were horrified, but they could do nothing to stop it because citizenship is determined by the country that's granting citizenship. Unfortunately, that Maltese passport is a Schengen zone passport. So, you know, all these people could just buy this passport or invest in the country and gain citizenship by their contributions and their real ties to the country, which could include joining a club or renting out an empty basement apartment would qualify you. Movie tickets to show that you attended something. These people were just, gaining multi-citizenship without a whole lot of struggle, as the passport papers investigation revealed, and then going off and living in London or some other country. So it was creating a backdoor into Europe from Malta for all these people of some quite undesirable characters. So for the Maltese people, the EU membership was a huge positive. But I think for the European Union, it created some major negatives, such as Malta acting as a dirty backdoor into Europe for people who now have citizenship and for dirty money and all sorts of other stuff, especially primarily under the Muscat years.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think we are running short of time here, which is unfortunate because I have a lot more questions I would like to ask you. Ryan, I really enjoyed your book. I learned a lot about Malta. I knew practically nothing about it. I had forgotten even that it was in the EU. So I appreciate learning so much from your book, and also for you kind of detailing, really the murder of a journalist, somebody who dedicated her life to kind of exposing corruption and, trying to strive for the truth. So I appreciate your book. It was interesting. It was funny in the first few chapters, and then it turned very dark. So I think in that respect, it's a well-balanced book. Before we kind of sign off, the outro.
You had one. You told me when we talked before, you were going to ask me a tough. You had one tough question that you were going to lay on me.
Okay. You want me?
Yeah, I want you time? To. Yeah, for sure. We have time. I think it's a really good question, and it's something that's definitely going to come up as a foreigner writing about Malta. So, yeah, lay that on me.
Yeah. So the question that I wanted to ask you about had to do with, when I read your book, I kept on thinking back to my years in graduate school, studying Spanish history and culture. And in Spanish history and culture, there's this concept called the Black Legend, which in the historiography is kind of is described as kind of a conspiracy to denigrate the Spanish character by pointing out the negatives, pointing out the bad things that Spain did in Latin America and the Inquisition and these types of things. And one of the kind of indicators that they point to is, they point to a lot of different indicators, but one that is often cited is, people in the rest of Europe who are challenging this kind of mighty power, Spain, try to denigrate it. And they say that it's not European. I think it was Alexander Dumas who says that Africa begins at the Pyrenees, right? Mm. Just where Spain starts. And that reminded me, something in your book reminded me of that quote. I think it was the French Jules Verne who said something about Africa begins in Malta or something like that. Mm. And so this just reminded me of Spanish historiography and Spanish scholarship. And I was just wondering, what would you say to the critic who reads your book and says, well, this is just another example of a foreigner who wants to bash and denigrate, the pride and the character of Malta. What do you say to those critics?
Mm. It's a great question, because that's something that comes up quite a lot, actually, whether it's the EU criticizing the rule of law in Malta or a foreigner or a foreign resident, go back to your country, you're just a big country attacking a small country, or you're bullying us or whatever. So I was thinking about that when you first mentioned it to me, and I have to kind of divide that into two parts. It's not going to be like a 2-second answer, but bear with me. If I remember right, I quoted Verne. He said that Maltese are Africans, and he described the characteristics of the culture that he saw at that time as African. And there is a deep African connection. Like, it's not an easy period to learn about. There's a popular 4-volume guidebook series to the island's antiquities that I use quite often. The thing I liked most about the country is that the ruins from all these different civilizations were all around you, and you could go out and look for this stuff right outside your door. And there's an entire book dedicated to the time of the Knights of Malta. That was 268 years that they were there. And, they left perhaps the largest visible mark in terms of structures. But the Arab period was nearly as long. It's only 11 years shorter than the time of the Knights, but it gets 14 pages in those 4 volumes. They talk about the Romans, the Phoenicians, the Middle Ages, the prehistory. But the Arab period is kind of covered up. And the historian who wrote about it the most, this guy called Godfrey Wettinger, He made a convincing case that Malta was entirely depopulated in 870, as I mentioned before, and then left empty for over 100 years, and then repopulated from North Africa, and it remained Muslim for another 257 years, right up until the Normans came and kind of forced Catholicism on everyone. Wettinger got so much grief for writing about this. Like, paint was thrown onto his front door. He was threatened. He suffered so much that he just stopped publishing about the topic. And I guess it's because it conflicts with that narrative I was telling you about earlier, this unbroken history of Catholicism and the strong identification with, you know, Christianity and being the defenders of Christianity. But so much that makes Malta utterly unique comes from that period, that Arab period. The language is basically a dialect of Arabic. It started off as a dialect of Arabic. It's the only Semitic language in the EU. And, you know, over the centuries, it brought in Italian and English loanwords and, you know, some very unique slang and some really remarkably poetic ways of swearing. And it developed into its own language. The building style is very much, especially in the old village cores, is very much a North African or even from the Levant building style, the way they use stone and the countryside as well, the farmhouses. The best of their foods come from this period. The figs, the almonds, you know, the spices. So that long Arab period made Malta unique in the same way that Andalusia is different from the rest of Spain. And I always saw that as something to be proud of, you know, something to be celebrated, not something to be looked down on. So I don't see that as a slight in any way. I think it's one of the most interesting aspects of their culture. And it's a shame that people don't pay more attention to it, I think. And you mentioned as well, my accusations of piracy and corruption. You're right to point out too, that like I wrote about the time of the knights and how they had shifted into common piracy at one point, but this was a time when legalized privateering was common, and you know, they weren't alone in doing this. I mean, the British were doing it as well. So I connected it to the sort of forms of legal piracy that exist in Malta now, like offshore companies and, you know, draining tax revenues from Europe, but privateering was common. It's not something uniquely corrupt about Malta. And a certain level of political corruption is common throughout the Mediterranean. And it seems to be kind of a part of life in small societies where like everybody knows everybody. It's how you get a job. It's how you get permits and connections. So Malta's not uniquely tainted in that by any stretch. But that being said, I am a foreigner attacking piracy and corruption under the regime of Joseph Muscat. And like when he didn't fire those involved in the Panama Papers, when they were exposed and he protected them instead of firing them, it sent a very clear message. And add in the citizenship by investment program, cash for EU passports, which Muscat pimped on several occasions personally in Dubai. And then a very suspicious public-private partnership with hospitals, where they turned over three public hospitals to a known Indian-Canadian fraudster. I mean, the message they're sending is that Malta is open for business, and shady people just began to flood in. That's where the title, that's what the title refers to, the shady people that are attracted to Malta since 2013 under Muscat. The gaming, online gaming companies, cryptocurrency, the online gaming companies, the Italian police described it as an ATM for the Italian mafia. They were laundering so much money through it. Fuel smuggling from Libya, human trafficking, drug trafficking, tuna laundering. Like, if there was a scam, it came to Malta, and there was always someone willing to look the other way or to facilitate it. So all this corruption is well documented ad nauseum in the press, both local and foreign. It is corrupt, and modern day piracy is flourishing there. And I think Joseph Muscat and his inner circle are responsible for it. And so did the public inquiry into Daphne Caruana Galizia's murder. So I'm not a foreigner attacking Malta. In fact, I'm on the side of those people who flooded Valletta every night in November 2019 and drove Joseph Muscat from office. I'm on the side of the investigative journalists of the shift and my fellow columnists who continue to investigate this stuff despite the risks and continue to write about corruption. You know, I'm on the side of civil society groups like Republica, who have launched several important court cases, and the women of Occupy Justice, who kept Daphne's memory alive for so long when the government was doing so much to suppress it. And, you know, I'm on the side of all those people who want to take back their country from Joseph Muscat's mob, so that Malta can, you know, be the jewel of the Mediterranean once more, and more like the place that I first knew when I first moved there. So that's how I would answer those critics.
Well, thank you for that, Ryan. And thanks to everyone for joining us. And thanks to Trinity University Press for hosting us tonight. For those in the audience, if you'd like to purchase a copy of Ryan's new book, A Sunny Place for Shady People, you can purchase it at a discount by visiting tupress.org for Trinity University Press and receive 25% off by using the promo code SPSP25. So SPSP for Sunny Place for Shady People, 25% off at checkout. And while you're there, you can sign up for their e-blast to hear more about these events and these interviews. So go check that out if you have a moment. Thank you, everyone, for coming out, and have a beautiful rest of your week.
Thanks, Jeremy. It's great to talk to you.
Likewise, Ryan.
You can find the episode show notes and much more at travelwritingworld.com. Please remember to subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast app. And if you find the show valuable, please consider leaving a review or supporting the show with only a few dollars a month at travelwritingworld.com/support.